Welcome to Listen 2. This is Ted. The news was published on Tuesday, October 8th. Joining us today are Eric and Kate. Let's dive right in. Today we're discussing a groundbreaking study on how daily routines impact brain function over time. Eric, Kate, what are your initial thoughts on this research?
Man, this study is a real eye-opener. It's showing us that the little choices we make every day, you know, hitting the snooze button or going for a jog, they're not just fleeting moments. They're leaving a mark on our brains for weeks. It's like we're constantly rewiring our noggins without even realizing it. Talk about a wake-up call for personal responsibility, huh?
While it's certainly intriguing, I've got some serious reservations about this study. I mean, come on, they only followed one person.
Hold up, Kate. Sure, it's just one person, but think about the depth of data they collected over 5 months. We're talking quality over quantity here. This isn't your run-of-the-mill survey study. They've got a treasure trove of detailed information that gives us a unique window into how the brain responds to daily life.
But Eric, you can't seriously think one person's experience represents everyone. That's just not how science works. We need larger studies with diverse participants.
I get where you're coming from, Kate. But sometimes a deep dive into one case can reveal patterns we'd miss in broader studies. It's like studying a drop of water to understand the ocean. Plus, this could pave the way for larger studies down the road.
Let's dive into the specifics. What were the key findings of this study?
Well, Ted, the researchers found that our brain activity isn't just responding to what's happening right now. It's like our gray matter is playing the long game. Sleep patterns, how much we move our butts, our moods, even how we breathe. All of these things are shaping our brain activity over days and weeks. It's not just a fleeting effect. It's more like brain marination.
True, but we can't ignore the elephant in the room here. The lead researcher was also the subject of the study. That's a clear conflict of interest if I've ever seen one.
I've got to disagree with you there, Kate. Her dual role actually brought some unique insights to the table. Think about it. She was able to maintain research integrity over months of data collection because she was living it. It's like she was both the scientist and the lab rat, giving us a perspective we rarely get in research.
But that's exactly the problem. Her personal biases could have skewed the results. We need objective third-party
Kate,
research.
I hear your concerns, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yes, we should be aware of potential bias, but her unique position also allowed for a level of detail and consistency that's hard to achieve in larger studies. It's a trade-off, and in this case, I think the benefits outweigh the risks.
Interesting points. How did the researchers track brain function over time?
They really went all out on this one, Ted. They used a triple threat approach, brain scans, wearable devices, and smartphones. It's like they created a 360-degree view of this person's brain and life. This is cutting-edge stuff in neuroscience research. We're not just looking at the brain in a lab anymore. We're seeing how it functions in the real world, day in and day out.
Sure, it sounds fancy, but let's pump the brakes a bit. Wearable tech isn't always accurate, you know. Those fitness trackers can be off by miles sometimes. We need to question the
reliability. I get your skepticism, Kate, but you're missing the forest for the trees here. They're not just relying on one type of data. It's the combination of multiple sources that give strength to these findings. The wearables, the brain scans, the smartphone data, they all work together to paint a more complete picture.
Even so, we can't just assume these devices capture everything accurately. There's always room for error. And when we're talking about something as complex as the brain, those
of course there's room for error, Kate. That's true in any study. But by using multiple data sources, they're actually reducing the impact of any single source of error. It's like triangulating. You get a more accurate position when you have multiple reference points. This approach gives us a more robust understanding of brain function than we've ever had before.
Let's look at this study in a broader context. Can you think of any similar historic research that paved the way for this kind of long-term brain study?
Absolutely, Ted. This immediately reminds me of the Framingham Heart Study. It kicked off way back in 1948, and it's still going strong today. Just like this brain study, it's all about tracking how our daily lives impact our health over the long haul. The Framingham Study has been following thousands of people for decades, giving us groundbreaking insights into heart health. It completely revolutionized our understanding of cardiovascular risk factors.
That's quite a stretch, Eric. The Framingham study is in a whole different league. It's massive, spanning generations, with thousands of participants. This brain study is just a blip in comparison. You can't
hold your horses, Kate. I'm not saying they're identical, but the principle is the same. Both studies are trying to understand how our everyday lives impact our health over time. The Framingham study changed the game for heart disease research, and this brain study could do the same for neuroscience. It's about seeing the big picture, not just snapshots.
But the Framingham study has concrete outcomes, Eric. It's given us clear risk factors for heart disease. This brain study's findings seem vague in comparison. We can't.
I hear you, Kate, but remember, the Framingham study didn't yield all its insights overnight. It took years of data collection and analysis. This brain study is just the beginning, and it's already showing us how our daily habits can impact our brain function for weeks. That's pretty concrete, if you ask me.
How does the methodology of these studies compare?
Great question, Ted. The Framingham study relies on good old-fashioned methods like regular checkups and surveys. It's tried and true, no doubt. This new brain study, though, it's taking advantage of all the cool tech we've got now. We're talking wearables, frequent brain scans. It's like comparing a horse-drawn carriage to a Tesla. Both will get you there, but the Tesla's giving you a whole lot more data along the way.
That's exactly my point, Eric. The Framingham study's methods are proven. They've stood the test of time. This new study's reliance on tech is unproven. We don't
Come on, Kate. That's how science moves forward. We don't stick with horse-drawn carriages just because they're proven. We build on what we've learned and use new tools to dig deeper. The Framingham study laid the groundwork, and now we're taking it to the next level with this brain research.
I'm not convinced, Eric. We need more evidence that these new methods are reliable. Just because something's new and shiny doesn't mean it's better. We could be.
I get your caution, Kate, but remember, every new method was unproven at some point. The key is to validate these new approaches rigorously, which is exactly what the study is doing. They're not just throwing out the old playbook, they're adding new chapters to it.
Interesting comparison. How might this brain study impact future research as the Framingham study did?
Oh man, Ted, the potential here is huge. This could be the start of a revolution in personalized healthcare. Imagine being able to track brain changes in real time, catching the earliest signs of neurological disorders before they become serious problems. It's like having a check engine light for your brain. This study is laying the groundwork for a whole new approach to mental health and cognitive well-being.
That's a big leap, Eric. We're light years away from being able to do that reliably. You're getting carried away with sci-fi fantasies here.
I hear your skepticism, Kate, but that's how progress happens. Remember, people probably thought the idea of predicting heart attacks was far-fetched when the Framingham study started. This brain study is a crucial first step towards a future where we can proactively manage our brain health. It's ambitious, sure, but that's what drives innovation.
First steps are important, Eric. But we shouldn't overstate their significance. There's a long road ahead before we can even think about practical applications.
Being realistic doesn't mean we can't be excited about the potential, Kate. Yes, there's a long road ahead, but this study is like the first flight at Kitty Hawk. It might seem small now, but it could lead to amazing developments down the line. We've got to start somewhere, and this is a pretty impressive start if you ask me.
Looking ahead, how do you think this research might unfold in the future? Eric, what's your prediction?
I've got to tell you, Ted, I think we're on the brink of a boom in personalized brain health monitoring. Picture this: apps and devices that track our daily habits and predict our cognitive performance. It'll be like having a personal brain trainer in your pocket. We're talking about a future where you can make real-time adjustments to your lifestyle based on how it's affecting your brain. It's not just about avoiding problems, it's about optimizing our mental performance.
That's a dystopian nightmare, Eric. Do we really want constant surveillance of our brains? This is seriously alarming. We're talking about opening up our most private thoughts.
Whoa, slow down there, Kate. This isn't about surveillance, it's about empowerment. We're not talking about mind reading here. It's about giving people the tools to understand how their lifestyle choices impact their brain health. It's no different from using a fitness tracker to improve your physical health. Knowledge is power, and in this case, it's the power to make informed decisions about our cognitive well-being.
But it could lead to discrimination, Eric. Can you imagine employers demanding to see your brain health scores? Or insurance companies denying coverage?
I understand your concerns, Kate, but let's not jump to worst-case scenarios. Any new technology can be misused, but that doesn't mean we should avoid developing it. The key is to put proper regulations and safeguards in place. The potential benefits: early detection of neurological issues, personalized mental health strategies, far outweigh the hypothetical risks.
Interesting points. Kate, what's your alternative vision for how this research might develop?
Look, I hope this research leads us to take a more critical look at how our environment affects our brain. Instead of just focusing on individual habits, we need to examine the bigger picture. What about the impact of work stress, air pollution, or social inequality on brain health? We should be pushing for policies that promote better sleep, reduced stress, and more physical activity for everyone, not just those who can afford fancy gadgets.
That's all well and good, Kate, but it's pretty vague. How would you actually implement that? We can't just wave a magic wand and fix society. People need actionable
steps. It's not about magic wands, Eric. It's about creating systemic change. We could start by advocating for workplace policies that prioritize employee well-being, like flexible hours or mandatory break periods. We could push for urban planning that encourages physical activity and reduces stress. And we definitely need to address the socioeconomic factors that contribute to poor brain health. It's about creating an environment where healthy choices are the easy choices for everyone.
But individual choices matter too, Kate. We can't just blame society for everything. People need to take responsibility for their own health. Your approach sounds like it's removing
personal accountability. Of course, individual choices matter, Eric. But we need to address root causes, not just symptoms. It's much easier for people to make healthy choices when their environment supports those choices. We need a holistic approach that combines individual responsibility with societal support.
Both perspectives raise important points. How might these different approaches be combined?
You know, Ted, I think there's a middle ground here. We could use the individual data from studies like this to inform broader public health policies. It's not an either-or situation. Imagine if we could identify patterns in brain health across different communities or occupations. That kind of data could guide targeted interventions and policy changes. We'd be combining the personal approach with the societal one.
I'm skeptical of relying too heavily on individual data, Eric. We need to consider privacy concerns. How can we ensure this information won't be misused? And what about people who
privacy is definitely
these?
Important, Kate. I'm with you there. But we can't let fear hold us back from advancing our understanding of brain health. We need to find a balance. Maybe we could use anonymized, aggregated data for policy decisions while keeping individual data private. And as for affordability, that's where public health initiatives come in. We could have community programs that provide access to these tools for everyone.
That balance is tricky, Eric. We shouldn't rush into widespread adoption of these technologies without careful consideration. There are ethical
You're right that we need to be careful, Kate, but we also can't afford to drag our feet. Brain health is too important. I say we move forward cautiously but steadily. Let's set up ethical guidelines and privacy protections as we go. We can adapt and improve as we learn more. The potential benefits for mental health and neurological disorders are just too big to ignore.
Thank you both for this insightful discussion. It's clear that this research opens up exciting possibilities, but also raises important questions about privacy, equity, and the balance between individual and societal approaches to brain health. As this field develops, it'll be crucial to address these concerns while harnessing the potential benefits. Thanks for tuning in, listeners. This is Ted, signing off from Listen 2.